Yeah, these are the amendments to the supplement agreement, and then there's the exhibit 4.1, you know, the thing you have your amendments.
Okay.
Yeah. And the mayor and I have discussed them all, and I think they're fairly straightforward.
That's weird. Oh, there it is.
Yeah.
Where that went.
I think we've actually pulled it together in a remarkably short time. When did you first get to see it? The proposal.
All right, are we ready to go? All right, good afternoon, everybody. This is a continuation of the Thursday, August 3rd afternoon session of the Portland City Council. We are back in session. We are going to read the three following items for the afternoon together. If you could read 871, 872, and 873, please.
871, appoint new post-deadly force procedures for police bureau and authorize legal proceedings to determine validity. 872, approving amendments to settlement agreement between the United States and the City of Portland in United States District Court, case number 312CV02265-SI, and plan for the Portland Commission on Community Engaged Policing. And 873, amend independent police review code to revise filing process, investigation, and appeal provisions of complaints of police officer misconduct.
Colleagues and folks, welcome and thank you all for being here today. There are people here in this chamber. There are also people in the overflow room. I want to assure people that... Excuse me, sit down. You are already disrupting the proceedings, and if you continue, you'll be asked to leave. This will all become relevant later. This is an important hearing on a subject of great importance to all Portlanders. I know that today's conversation is going to be a tough one, and that these are emotionally charged issues. Our community is ever-changing and evolving, and policing must evolve too. I was elected in part on a platform to improve the police bureau. During my campaign, I identified 10 key reforms or improvements that I want to see as both the police commissioner and as the mayor. Those 10 reforms are still available. They're on my website, and I'm completely committed to seeing those reforms through. The ordinances we're going to discuss today address some of those changes. It's important to me that we continue to build trust between our police bureau and the community by strengthening accountability and providing meaningful opportunities for public engagement. The ordinance that I'm bringing today come after months of facilitated discussion, mediation, and other input. These ordinances give us a path to compliance with the DOJ settlement agreement, an agreement that I made clear during my campaign for mayor that I would support. I support the tenets of that agreement regardless of who is in the White House. In the absence of these ordinances being adopted today, the path to compliance is much less clear, and you're going to hear why during the testimony. There's understandably a lot of public interest in these matters. The council is here today to listen with an open mind. None of my colleagues, none of them, have pledged support to any of these ordinances prior to this hearing. All of them have indicated that they want to hear public testimony on these three ordinances before making a decision. Therefore, it's important that we get through public testimony without disruption. All of us here today, I assume, want everyone, regardless of their point of view on these ordinances, to have the opportunity to express their views. For the benefit of everyone who came today, who wants to be heard, I'm asking everyone to adhere to the council rules of conduct. They're basic. Be respectful of people testifying. Allow them to have their voice heard. Allow them to speak uninterrupted. Under council rules, disruptions are not allowed. If you disrupt the proceedings, you will be asked to leave. Because if you're disrupting the proceedings, that means somebody who waited to come and speak their piece doesn't get to be heard. If you're asked to leave because you're disrupting other people's testimony or council deliberations and you choose not to leave, then you could find yourself arrested for trespassing. Those are the council rules. We don't like to do that. And I assume nobody here today wants that to happen. I'm convinced that here in Portland, Oregon, we can have a forum on policing while abiding by the rules of decorum. I'm convinced that we can both be heard and that we can hear. I ask for your help in ensuring that we do so. Today we're going to hear on three ordinances that are essential in fulfilling our responsibilities under the DOJ settlement agreement. Here's the run of show, just so you know what to expect. A brief introduction by me. I'm going to talk just very, very briefly about the three ordinances, not get into any detail, call it the 30,000-foot view and why I think each of the ordinances is important. There'll be a staff presentation. We'll have invited testimony. And in case you're wondering, I've actually invited people who do not agree with these ordinances. I think it's fair to hear all sides of this issue. I'll ask my colleagues if they have any questions or wish to offer amendments based on the staff presentation or invited testimony. We'll take public testimony. Council amendments will then be offered based on the public testimony if people, council members, so choose. We'll have our deliberations, and then we'll make a decision. So that's the run of show. With regard to the three ordinances, there are three. The first one, item 871, court review of compelled interviews. The first ordinance attempts to resolve questions around the so-called 48-hour rule. Much has been written about this. Much has been said about this. Unfortunately, with regard to my position on it, much of what has been said and written is inaccurate.
Excuse me, apparently the captions are not working.
One moment. We're going to wait while we see what's happening with the captions. I'm sorry. Let's take a quick... Are they back up? Okay, thanks. And please let me know if the captions stop working. The first ordinance attempts to resolve questions around the 48-hour rule. It's my belief that we can, in fact, compel an officer involved in the use of deadly force to interview within 48 hours for the purposes of an employment investigation. Further, I believe that the employment investigation can be effectively walled off from the criminal investigation. Unfortunately, the Oregon Constitution, as interpreted by people who are very knowledgeable about the Oregon Constitution, the Multnomah County District Attorney, the Oregon Department of Justice, and others, indicate that compelled interviews and walled-off employment investigations are not sufficient. This interpretation of the law is the best interpretation we have at this time, but I'm not convinced that a case from 1982 should be the final word on issues critical to police accountability and the public trust today. That's why this ordinance, if passed, creates a policy that would compel interviews and wall off employment investigations. I oppose the 48-hour rule. I'm clearly on the record to that effect. The previous council paid a steep price to eliminate the rule, and I want it gone. While I oppose the portion of the use of force policy that refers to compelled interviews, I am not prepared to immunize an officer who uses deadly force from criminal prosecution. The policy before the council today is a good policy. We think it's legal, and we're going to take it to court so that a judge can tell us that we're right. The next ordinance, 872, PSEP and other amendments to the DOJ settlement agreement. The next ordinance makes amendments to the DOJ settlement agreement. The item that's obviously gotten the most attention is the Portland Commission on Community Engaged Policing, or PSEP. Meetings of the former COAB devolved into shouting matches, racist and sexist slurs, and even threats. Appointed members expressed actual fear about attending meetings. Many felt threatened or harassed. Many members of that organization called the COAB resigned, including two of its chairs. The police refused to show up, and the city council, for the most part, refused to appoint replacement members until the process was reformed. The new engagement body that this ordinance contemplates, PSEP, will allow for the dissemination of information to the community and meaningful public feedback. It will turn what was previously chaos into credibility. PSEP will propel community engagement into subject areas that go beyond what was originally contemplated in the settlement agreement. And PSEP is planned not just to exist for the remainder of the settlement agreement while it's in place, but it's intended to go on long after the settlement agreement is gone, providing a permanent and reliable community engagement vehicle. We interviewed many, not all, but many former COAB members for this process. They rightly complained that the city had also contributed to the COAB not being as successful as it could have been. I listened to them, and I agree with them. They rightly complained that there was insufficient orientation and training. The PSEP fixes that. There was no responsiveness from the city government to their recommendations, and often their questions went unanswered. The PSEP fixes that too, and it requires responsiveness on the part of the city. There is also no self-direction. The PSEP gets to set its own direction. The broad parameters allow them to take up any issue related to constitutional policing, but it allows them to go into new areas that the COAB was not allowed to go into, including racial justice issues, something that I hope people understand is important to me and to my administration. The board will hold quarterly town halls with the public, and they'll have other time set aside to do their work. They'll also have the ability to schedule additional public meetings and outreach activities if they so choose. The police will be required to participate in the quarterly public meetings, unlike at the COAB, where the police chose not to participate. The PSEP, in my opinion, is a key part of bringing us into compliance with the settlement agreement. Third and finally, the independent police review code changes. The final ordinance will improve the independent police review in the police bureau's internal affairs. If passed, these bodies will be able to provide recommended findings following an administrative investigation of alleged officer misconduct. This conforms with national best practices around police accountability. The complainants and involved officers will be informed of the recommended findings when notified of the police bureau's ultimate disposition of a complaint. So those are my 30,000-foot assessments of these three ordinances. At this point, we'll get into the invited testimony. First up, we have the city attorney, Tracy Reeve, the senior policy advisor on the Portland Commission on Community Engaged Policing, Nicole Grant from my administration, and Constantine Severe, who's the IPR director. They will come on up and discuss some of the issues in more detail. And, of course, my colleagues will have the opportunity, as always, to ask questions should they so choose. So, Tracy, I'll start off with you, if you don't mind. And thank you for being here, all three of you.
Thank you, Mayor, Commissioners. I'm Tracy Reeve. I'm the Portland City Attorney. And I'm here to outline today the legal reasons for and the effects of...
Are we losing the
microphone?
Is the green light on?
It's on.
Okay. Okay, thank you. And please do raise your hand if you cannot hear, or if we lose the captions, please let me know. Thank you.
So I'm here to briefly outline the legal reasons for and effect of the two ordinances before you today.
I have to agree. It sounds like it's not. Would you mind, Nicole, passing your mic over and see if that one works better?
Does this work better?
No.
Carla's going to
Hold on just a second.
Keep talking to Tracy.
Okay.
Is that good? Okay, good. Thank you.
All right. So I'm going to briefly discuss, and not as briefly as I would like, but as briefly as possible, the legal bases for and effects of two of the ordinances before you today, in addition to item 873, which Director Severe will cover. First, I want to take this opportunity to acknowledge my continuing appreciation for the partnership the city has enjoyed in its police reform efforts with the attorneys from the United States Attorney's Office and the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice. U.S. Attorney Bill Williams and his team are here today. They have been working with the City of Portland since the beginning of the DOJ investigation to support the city's commitment to the principles of 21st century policing.
Tracy, could you stop? Apparently, we're having problems with the sound upstairs. We'll take a break till we get that sorted. Could you let me know, Carla, when it's sorted out?
I don't know what's going on.
So now the live feed has been cut to the Lovejoy room just to know that.
Is it on? Could I please have one of my staff members go to the overflow room? And I want to know ASAP if either the video, the sound, or the captions are not working. It does not have to be you, Mustafa, but if you could make sure somebody goes. Thank you. So it's working now? Sorry, Tracy. Please continue.
Okay, thank you. So to provide some context, I would like to briefly summarize how we got here. In 2010, Aaron Campbell, an African-American man who was experiencing a mental health crisis, was shot and killed by a Portland police officer. Commissioner Saltzman was the police commissioner at the time, and he and then-Mayor Sam Adams, together with a number of community advocates, including Dr. Bethel and Dr. Haynes, who are also with us today, requested that the United States Department of Justice conduct an investigation of the Portland Police Bureau. In 2011, the U.S. DOJ agreed to do so. And in September of 2012, they completed their investigation and issued a findings letter acknowledging the openness and cooperation of the city and PPB and recognizing that PPB was committed to improving its processes. In fact, the findings letter acknowledged that PPB had already begun to take steps to address the concerns raised during the investigation. The DOJ investigation found that while most uses of force were constitutional, there was evidence that PPB had a pattern or practice of using unnecessary force in interactions with people experiencing mental illness or perceived to be mentally ill. The city and DOJ had already begun to work to develop a plan to address the findings and to improve PPB's provision of services. And in November of 2012, Mayor Adams brought a proposed settlement agreement to this council for its approval. Following some amendments, that agreement was approved by council on November 14, 2012, and was signed by the city and the United States December 17, 2012. Immediately thereafter, as the parties had agreed would occur, the Department of Justice filed a federal court lawsuit to ensure that, should it become necessary to do so, the court would have authority to enforce the settlement agreement. Although the settlement agreement was not finally approved by the court until 2014, the city began implementing the reforms right away. The settlement agreement had seven major categories of actions to be taken by the Portland Police Bureau and the City of Portland. Those seven categories are use of force, training, community-based mental health services, crisis intervention, employee information system, officer accountability, and community engagement in the creation of the Community Oversight Board, Community Oversight Advisory Board, known as the COAB. The structure of the settlement agreement was set forth in Section 10, and it was unique. The oversight and implementation provisions, the parties sought to continue the collaborative relationship that they'd established and to reflect the fact that the city had been a willing and active participant all along the way. It was determined that it was not necessary or desirable to have a traditional consent decree or a court-appointed monitor. The agreement instead placed direct responsibility for compliance with the city's elected officials, all of you, the city council. Also unique were the implementation and enforcement provisions of Section 10, which provided that the city would select a compliance officer and community liaison, now known as the COCL, who would collect, analyze, and synthesize compliance data, and who would oversee the COAB, which would engage the public in the process and which would be overseen by the COCL. The COCL has responsibility for preparing compliance assessments for the DOJ and the public. The DOJ is ultimately responsible for monitoring compliance with the agreement, and if the Department of Justice finds that the city has failed to comply with its obligations under the agreement after a reasonable opportunity to do so, there are certain steps outlined for the parties to attempt to resolve the issues, and if that does not work, the Department of Justice can go to court and ask to have the city held in breach, at which point the federal judge has the authority, has broad authority to order remedies to correct the city's breach. A fairness hearing on the settlement agreement was eventually held, and the agreement was approved as fair, adequate, and reasonable. The Portland Police Association was allowed to intervene as a party, and the Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition was granted enhanced amicus status. Over the past 5 years, the city has made very substantial progress towards compliance in six of the seven key areas that I mentioned. And I'm just going to very briefly identify some of the key items that the city has undertaken. In the area of use of force, all reportable uses of force are now reviewed up through the chain of command. The Portland Police Bureau now has a force audit team with certified force auditors, which permits the Bureau to analyze members' uses of force to assure conformity to directives, laws, and the settlement agreement on a quarterly basis, which is provided to command staff for review and feedback, as well as to the training division for identification of possible training implications, and new use of force policies have been adopted. And those force audit reports are also available to the COCAL and the Department of Justice. Training. PPB now has a brand new one-stop training facility with a wide range of...
Tracy, could I ask you to slow down just a little bit because we have some translation going on. Thank you.
With a wide range of capabilities for various disciplines, more scenario-based trainings are conducted. The Bureau has an increased and continued focus on de-escalation and disengagement. Additional training has been developed and qualification required for the use of electronic control weapons, and what we know as tasers. Equity training has been provided to all sworn members at in-service. In 2018, all members will receive implicit bias training, and command staff has already received that training. The training division developed and now utilizes a more formalized needs assessment to determine future training topics, and the Bureau has purchased and is in the process of implementing a new learning management system for the tracking of all elements of the training program. In addition, all officers, all Portland Police Bureau officers, have received 40 hours of core crisis intervention training. In terms of the section of the agreement that related to community-based mental health services, the agreement recognized that the city was not responsible for community-based mental health services, but nonetheless, the city agreed to try to advance the objective of improving the community-based mental health system. The city was and PPB were instrumental in organizing initially organizing various stakeholders to explore the creation of a psychiatric emergency center in Portland for persons who were in behavioral crisis in lieu of having to take those persons to general hospital emergency rooms, which were not designed or staffed to respond to their needs. This collaborative effort, and it was the work of many, many organizations, certainly not just the city, but many health providers, private donors, the hospitals in the area, and others came together. And this collaborative effort led to the opening of the Unity Center in February 2017, which is the first facility of its kind in the state of Oregon. The city also worked with the State Addictions and Mental Health Division and County Mental Health to amend state administrative rules so that AMR, the ambulance service, could transport persons on civil commitment holds to Unity, which was important so that PPB no longer had to cuff and place persons experiencing a mental health crisis into a caged car to be transported for care and treatment. And PPB is now out of the business of transporting persons who are only on behavioral health holds or mental health holds, except in extraordinary circumstances, although the Bureau does continue to work with Unity, as there have been some issues of concern. With regard to crisis intervention, the Bureau created the crisis intervention training and the enhanced crisis intervention training programs. As I mentioned, all officers receive 40 hours of core crisis intervention training, and 133 officers have volunteered to be trained as enhanced crisis intervention training officers and have received 80 hours of enhanced crisis intervention training. The Bureau established the Behavioral Health Unit and expanded the number of behavioral health response teams, which pair a clinician and an officer so that PPB now has the ability to coordinate a response for those in behavioral health crisis. The Bureau created the Behavioral Health Unit Advisory Committee that includes peers and family members, along with representatives from local government, county, state, and social service organizations and advocacy groups. And that advisory committee is deeply involved in providing feedback to the behavioral health unit on policies, procedures, and trainings. And finally, as I mentioned, the Bureau developed the Enhanced Crisis Intervention Training Program and continues to conduct annual trainings for interested officers.
So can I just interrupt you for a second there? It's my understanding that all of the things you just listed have been deemed by the Department of Justice to be approximately the same as the Memphis model that's mentioned in the settlement agreement. Is that correct?
So the Memphis model was a slightly different model than the what has been called the hybrid model that the city adopted, and there was some back and forth with the Department of Justice as to whether the city's crisis intervention model should be evaluated on its own merits or should be evaluated as more effective or less effective than the model actually implemented in the city of Memphis. And the city felt that there were many features of its program that were actually better than the Memphis model, but it was sort of an impossibility to take something of apples and oranges and compare the cities and say it was better or worse than the Memphis model. And the city, in the course of the negotiations with the Department of Justice, we've now come to an agreement that they're going to evaluate the effectiveness of our model on its own merits, and we don't need to interject Memphis into the analysis.
Thank
Does that answer your question, Commissioner?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. The city has implemented, the PPB has implemented an early intervention or EIS system, which is intended to alert the Bureau early to problems with officers' use of force or other issues. It's created objective criteria for forwarding alerts to supervisors, increased the number of alerts sent to supervisors in the chain of command for review rather than being reviewed by the EIS administrator to improve internal accountability. And one of the more technical amendments to the settlement agreement concerns how teams and supervisor groups' performance is going to be evaluated, and the early intervention system has not proven to be effective for that. So in discussions, we have come to at least a conceptual agreement that the audit data, the force audit data, will be used for that one function. So that's one minor technical amendment. On the accountability front, the Bureau has worked collaboratively with Independent Police Review and the Department of Justice, and Director Sevier will talk more about this, to establish a mirrored system of policies and procedures for PPB, particularly Internal Affairs Division and IPR, to handle all administrative investigations to ensure accountability through complete and thorough investigations in all cases. The Bureau is also, and the Council has approved prior to today, some code changes that allow for all complaints of misconduct to be investigated. Previously, some complaints that didn't meet the standard for a full-on internal affairs or IPR investigation were administratively dismissed. Now those will go through a supervisor investigation route so that all complaints will be investigated at some level. So, that's the good news, but despite all of this progress, there have been some significant and thorny issues which have arisen as the city has sought to comply with both the letter and the spirit of the settlement agreement. First, a very serious issue, as the mayor adverted to, has arisen with regard to the investigation of officer-involved shootings and other uses of deadly force. Second, the city has struggled to successfully achieve the meaningful community engagement contemplated by the settlement agreement. Item 871 relates to the first of these issues, how the city investigates uses of deadly force resulting in death. The council has previously been very clear that it wants all uses of deadly force resulting in death to be promptly and thoroughly investigated by the Internal Affairs Division. And I just want to briefly clarify, two types of investigations occur following use of deadly force resulting in death by an officer. A criminal investigation is conducted, and under Oregon law, that criminal investigation is under the direction of the district attorney, in our case, Multnomah County District Attorney Underhill, who is here today. In addition, PPB as an employer, the city through the Bureau and its Internal Affairs Division, conducts an administrative investigation to determine if the officer's use of deadly force was within city and PPB policy and training. Those investigations have different potential outcomes. The DA's investigation could, if the facts warranted it, result in criminal charges. The administrative investigation by the city as an employer could result in discipline up to and including termination. So to try to achieve the council's desire of prompt administrative investigations of officer-involved shootings in particular, including prompt statements from the involved officer, the city negotiated a new contract with the Portland Police Association in 2016 that eliminated the so-called 48-hour rule. That rule had previously provided that, in most circumstances, a statement would not be compelled from an officer within the first 48 hours after the deadly force incident. Unfortunately, and despite the fact that the city put substantial effort into achieving that contract amendment, it's become clear that additional steps are necessary to achieve council's objective of prompt administrative statements. We've known for many years, in fact, since 1967, when the Supreme Court decided the Garrity case, that police officers, like all people, have constitutional rights against self-incrimination. The Garrity rule says that if a public employer compels a police officer under threat of discipline or termination to make a statement, that statement cannot be used against the officer in a criminal proceeding without violating the officer's Fifth Amendment rights. And so, as the city and the Department of Justice have been working for some time to develop procedures for administrative investigations of deadly force incidents that comply with so-called Garrity rule and cases following it and with Oregon law. Like the City Council, the Department of Justice has been consistent that it wants to see prompt reporting on uses of deadly force from involved officers. And as I mentioned, District Attorney Underhill, as the District Attorney for Multnomah County, has the legal responsibility for criminal death investigations in the city. DA Underhill has expressed concerns that some of the policies the city and the Department of Justice have contemplated or wanted to implement could negatively affect his ability to carry out the criminal investigation and, if necessary, to criminally prosecute. While these discussions between the city
could
and
I interrupt you?
Yes.
So give me a scenario. I'm not a lawyer and I don't prosecute. Give me a scenario where it could become problematic.
Well, if the say a shooting occurred, an individual was killed, and the city within 24 hours compelled a statement from that officer, the concern is that while federal law is clear that so long as that statement is essentially put in a lockbox and kept completely separate from the criminal investigation, that will not provide what's called transactional immunity, which means full immunity from prosecution for the events involved in the transaction about which the statement was compelled, full immunity. That you can segregate the administrative investigation from the criminal investigation. What the concern is that under Oregon law, there's a line of cases which, at least in some circumstances, says that's not good enough. Putting it in a lockbox isn't good enough. And if you compel the individual, in this case, it's important to note, did not occur in the context of a police officer. But the court did say if you compel someone in this grand jury context, you afford them transactional immunity, full immunity from prosecution around the subject of the statement. So, hypothetically speaking, you know, God forbid that this happened, but hypothetically speaking, if we had a Portland police officer who engaged in a completely unjustified shooting and shot someone in and engaged in behavior that would constitute criminal homicide, and we compelled that officer to give us an employment statement within 24 hours, the district attorney's concern, and certainly his interpretation of the case law is not unreasonable, is that that person would very likely have full immunity from criminal prosecution. So the city, by implementing the 10-10-10 policy that it would like to implement, which is our force reporting policy, and doing that runs the risk of, before a full criminal investigation can occur, before it can be determined whether or not the conduct was criminal, of immunizing that officer. The risk is admittedly small because not a lot of criminal prosecutions of officers occur, but you always have to take the likelihood of the risk occurring and then the severity of the risk that you're facing. And the likelihood of it occurring may be relatively small, but the severity could be very extreme if somebody essentially commits criminal homicide as a Portland police officer and we take conduct that means that that person cannot be held criminally accountable.
So let me paint you a scenario. Tell me whether, is this plausible or just ridiculous? Either way, I'm fine. So if I am the individual who is engaged in that shooting, and it is definitively a bad shooting, and I would obviously have a criminal defense attorney, what would my defense attorney do?
They would tell you not to voluntarily offer a statement.
But I already was compelled. So then he goes to the judge, my criminal defense attorney, and I assume he takes the district attorney's well-reasoned argument and the Department of Justice, the Oregon Attorney General's letter, which supports that argument, and he'll show it to the judge and say, dismiss the case, won't he?
Right. What would happen
isn't that the risk we're
concerned? It is exactly the risk that we're taking. The district attorney has a policy of taking all in-custody deaths to grand jury, assuming that a grand jury returned a true bill, meaning that they felt a criminal prosecution was warranted. The grand jury would then seek to prosecute that individual, and the individual would make a motion to the trial court judge and say, no, I'm entitled to immunity. I have a statement compelled over here. My constitutional rights against self-incrimination have been violated. And because this issue has been very prevalent, and because the district attorney has explained his reasoning in a memo, and the attorney general has agreed with that, you know, it's just the circumstances that would be exhibit one on the motion to dismiss. And I don't think a trial court would say, gee, the district attorney agrees that this confers or likely confers transactional immunity, and the AG agrees, but I'm going to try them anyway.
So the balance here is it's a long shot risk, but that long shot risk comes with significant consequences. The possibility here, the balance is we're losing the opportunity right now to compel in administrative employment investigations.
Correct.
But the flip side, the risk is we could potentially lose the opportunity to prosecute an obvious crime.
And that would
and
be
that's the balancing
that's a very
act.
Highly likely outcome the way things currently stand. It's
a
half.
Long shot risk, but it's a high. To put sort of a stupid frame on it, it's the same conversation we have around major earthquakes. It's a
right.
long shot risk, but if it happens, it's
correct.
Significant.
Correct. And
so meanwhile, so the action here isn't to throw our hands up in the air and say, oh, gosh, we quit. The action here is we're going to either, I don't know if it's an appellate court or a circuit court, but we're going to a state court, and we're asking, we believe we stand on strong legal ground based on what happens elsewhere, but we want that clarity from the courts. That's the basic argument.
What's before counsel today is the policy that we would like to implement, which requires prompt, compelled statements from officers following a deadly force incident within 48 hours, with 48 hours being the outside edge. It's not that we're going to wait till almost 48 hours. That's the outside edge of when that could occur. And then, because there's a state process, a state law process for seeking, where you have something like this, where counsel passes a policy, but there are questions as to the legal validity of that policy. State statutes provides for a process to go to court and say, court, please opine on whether this is legally valid or not. And so if you pass this ordinance, you will be adopting an alternative 10-10-10 policy that will compel employment statements of officers involved in uses of deadly force resulting in death in less than 48 hours from the incident. That policy will take effect after a court says, yes, this is a legal way to do it.
And the 48 hours here, where does the 48 hours come from? I got an email from a friend of mine who said, well, why not 24 hours? Why did you pick 48 hours? What's the deal there?
So, as I mentioned, the 48 hours, I think, reflects counsel's intent to get the value of its bargain with the PPA and the policy that it feels is really critical, which is getting that prompt statement from the officer after one of these events. The 48-hour rule, of course, comes from the former provision in the contract. As I mentioned, this policy, the new 10-10-10, nothing in this policy would require the Bureau to wait 48 hours or anywhere. In fact, it would quite the opposite. It says that it's expected that the officer will be compelled no later than within 48 hours. But it does not in any way preclude Internal Affairs Division from doing that 24 hours after.
Very good. And before I get to Commissioner Fritz, I just want to state something for the record. Prior to this being an issue, we have had four officer-involved shootings in my short tenure. The first one, of course, was Quanis Hayes. And for the record, since that criminal proceeding is over, I, in fact, did compel testimony prior to 48 hours.
Correct. And frankly, that is sort of where all of this came to a head, because once that occurred, the district attorney was very concerned that had that been a criminal shooting, it went to a grand jury, the grand jury returned a not true bill, so it did not end up being that bad situation that we talked about. But that is sort of what brought this issue into clear focus for all the parties. And at that point, as we were working with DOJ to try to kind of accommodate these two things, United States Attorney Bill Williams, who again is here with us today, said, I'm getting everybody together on this issue. The United States is not going to tell the elected district attorney of Multnomah County that we're going to override his interpretation of the law in an area that is entrusted by state law to him. So we all got in a room, we talked about it, we got a full understanding of the district attorney's position. He furnished us with a written analysis by his office. That analysis has been reviewed and in essence blessed by the Oregon Attorney General's office, and we then put together an alternative, the 10-10-10 policy that recently went into effect, which no one is happy with because it provides that the officer will not be compelled to give a statement until the district attorney either says, I'm fine with you compelling a statement at this point, or until the criminal investigation is concluded.
Commissioner Fritz.
So, again, what's the significance of the 48 hours under the present policy? Is the officer compelled after 72 hours? Doesn't that not mess up the criminal investigation?
No, the current policy that PPB just implemented, it does not. It provides that an officer will not be compelled to give a statement in the employment administrative investigation until either the district attorney says, yes, I'm okay with compelling him, or until the criminal investigation process is complete, which would normally, since the district attorney takes everything to the grand jury, it would normally be after the grand jury proceeding if there's no criminal prosecution. If there's a criminal prosecution, it would go longer.
So even under the previous rules, they couldn't compel after 48 hours either. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that issue is what became very clear after the Quanis Hayes shooting. And yes, that's when, we all sat down in a room and fully understood the import of the DA's analysis of Soriano. I think the city was focused, or my office was focused on what's called the Garrity analysis, which is the federal Fifth Amendment analysis. And because the Soriano case did not involve administrative employment investigations, we were not viewing that as clearly applicable to this situation as the district attorney does. Again, I think the legal argument can be made either way, but it is certainly not the position that the district attorney is taking based on that case is certainly not an unreasonable legal interpretation, and the risk is real.
So now what we're doing here is we agree with the community, most people in the community,
yes,
that we do want to be able to compel. So we're having a policy that says we can, but we're going to stay it until the court says whether we're right or not. Is that
correct?
Accurate?
And I want to just put this on the record. There may be we want the right to be able to do that without ramifications for a criminal prosecution. There may also be logistical reasons or investigative reasons why, even if we have that right, we do not do it. And I just want to be very clear with people. There could be circumstances where it is better for the investigators to do some lead work prior to that compelled statement. I just want people to be aware of that.
Correct. And I know one of the requests that I saw, at least on some of the testimony or community input that was submitted, was that it should be within 24 hours instead of 48 hours. That could, on occasion, not provide the investigators the time they need to get their ducks in a row before they sit down and interview the officer.
Commissioner Udaly.
May we have a... Wow. Mind meld. Okay. Thank you. I think we're getting a little confused on the 48-hour rule, or I haven't heard it clearly stated. What we had previously was officers who used deadly force were entitled to 48 hours notice before being compelled. Is that
correct? And the practice was, and the interpretation was, that officers generally were not compelled within the first 48 hours after the event.
Well, they couldn't be because we had to give them
There
notice.
Were certain circumstances under which the city could have, but yes.
So now we're saying we can compel, well, I mean, given a ruling in our favor, we'll be able to compel with no notice?
You know, I would have to look at the specifics of the contract. I doubt very much if it's no notice because
well,
in the 10-10-10...
1 hour, 12 hours. I'm just trying to... It's not... I feel like we were talking about this backwards as if the 48 hours comes from notice to the officer. So we're not now saying it has to happen within 48 hours.
The
we're
policy...
We can give a shorter notice.
The policy that you would be adopting if you pass this ordinance has the expectation, it is not just notice, it has the expectation that absent, I forget if the term is exigent or something like that, circumstances, the officer will be compelled within 48 hours.
Okay.
Okay, and I just wanted to, you know, as we've already identified, we believe that there are good arguments to be made that that in this particular circumstance where it's an administrative employment investigation and a criminal investigation, the Soriano line of cases should not be held to apply, and the city should be able, assuming it has appropriate procedures in place, to wall that statement off, get a statement promptly after the event, and that's what we would be asking the court to rule. And I will say that the district attorney has said in conversations with me and in public statements that he supports that effort to get a court interpretation and that he acknowledges that there is some gray area in the case law. Okay. The second item before you, were there any other questions right now about the first ordinance? The second item before you is item 872, which relates to the amendments to the settlement agreement. As previously touched upon, the city's made very significant progress toward compliance, and as of the last status conference last October, was in partial or substantial compliance with all sections except Section 9, which provided for the city to create the COAB. For a variety of reasons, and I won't belabor them, the mayor's already touched on them. It's clear with the benefit of hindsight that the city did not provide the training and vetting and other support to the members necessary before they began their work, that the charge to the COAB was very broad, that for a number of reasons, and I really want to emphasize this, despite the incredible efforts of many COAB volunteers who dedicated literally countless hours, well beyond what was expected when they agreed to serve, to work on this very important experiment in direct community participation in police reform, the COAB simply was not successful. We've attached as an exhibit Kathleen Sadat, who was the second chair of the COAB. She's an incredibly well-respected and talented leader in the community, deep ties to the civil rights community in Portland, the African American community in Portland, and the LGBTQ community in Portland. And she really put forth incredible effort to try to get the COAB back on track and did make significant improvements and was herself the target of terrible and abusive behavior. And she eventually resigned. And when she did so, she provided the city with an exit report, which is attached to the ordinance and details some of the issues that occurred, a lack of clarity regarding the COAB role, mission, process, and structure, and that all resulted in what eventually became insurmountable barriers to the success of the body. So, as the mayor noted, we reached a point where many COAB members had resigned, others felt unsafe, it was difficult for the body to obtain a quorum, and several COAB members called for a temporary halt to COAB activity. And in late August of 2016, after consultation regarding these issues, the city and the United States agreed to a 60-day hiatus of COAB activities. During that time, the city took numerous steps to engage with the community on a way forward and reported on those efforts at the October 2016 status conference. The city circulated a survey, participated in a forum generously hosted by Maranatha Church. Representatives of the mayor's office and my office reached out to and spoke with mental health peer support specialists, advocates, and providers for those experiencing or with a history of mental illness. City representatives spent many hours in discussion with members of the steering committee of the Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition, sought advice from other community and faith leaders, discussed the issues extensively with the COCL, with Ms. Sadat, and with Chief Justice Dominguez, who had been the first chair of the COAB. City staff also interviewed almost every former and current COAB member to get their perspective. And as a result of those efforts, on October 12, 2016, the city shared its first proposed framework for conceptual amendments to the COAB provisions. The city then, in that same month, October, there were additional meetings with the AMAC, the United States, and the PPA to discuss how to move forward with improvements. Mayor Hales and Commissioner Fritz attended those and reassured the AMAC of the city's continuing commitment to meaningful community engagement. The city suggested a facilitator might be useful to further advance discussions. The Portland Police Association and the AMAC had some discussions among themselves, and they proposed two facilitators to the city. The city retained one of the two suggested. In November and December of 2016, the AMAC and the PPA had additional meetings and provided a proposed document regarding their discussions to the city. Then in January, February, and March of 2017, the city, the AMAC, the Department of Justice, and the PPA held facilitated meetings to discuss how to move forward with the Community Engagement Board. Various proposals went back and forth. And at the last meeting in March, it was agreed that the city and the Department of Justice would meet without the other parties to prepare a more detailed proposal. Many of the meetings concerned the issue of whether the community engagement body should engage in oversight of the settlement agreement. And following many discussions, the parties agreed to accept Reverend Dr. Haynes' definition of oversight as the ability to review and make recommendations. In the meantime, the city and the Department of Justice entered into a Ninth Circuit mediation process, originally to address issues raised by the city in a writ of review as to the appropriate scheduling and role of the court. But since that time, the parties also utilized the mediation process to have meaningful discussions on how to move forward on the few but key areas where progress had stalled. Principal among those issues was the COAB. The other key issues related to the accountability issue we've just discussed about compelled officer statements, how to harmonize the intended outcome of robust civilian involvement with the intended outcome of timely results in the administrative investigations, and in particular, the time for CRC appeals, an improvement to the accountability system, which Director Sevier is going to discuss, to give the investigating body the ability to make recommended findings based on its investigation. And the issue I already mentioned about the employee information system. So the parties recognized in these discussions that, and had recognized for some period of time, that some amendments to the settlement agreement would be necessary after the 5 years of work under the settlement agreement. And the settlement agreement itself had always contemplated a process to make amendments should they become necessary. The parties knew that with a 180-page agreement or 180-paragraph agreement, they were unlikely to get absolutely everything right in the first place. So as a result of the mediation discussions, the members